From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. In Arizona, the governor and the state legislature decide to zero out state support for three large community colleges. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation announces a new advocacy strategy focused on state and federal education policy. Hi, this is Casey Green. I'm the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. So welcome all. Ahead of our conversation, please note that you can post your thoughts about these conversations on the comment section of the This Week page, insidehighered.com/thisweek. In our opening segment, we'll talk about $0 for community colleges in Arizona. During the Great Recession that began in 2008, the nation's community colleges confronted rising enrollments and significant budget cuts. Now, as the economy seems to have stabilized, Arizona Governor Doug Ducey, with support from the state legislature, has moved to cut all state funding for the Maricopa and Pima Community College districts, two of the state's largest community college systems. These cuts come as President Obama has advocated for free community college tuition, and other states are investing in their community colleges as a cost-effective way to provide workforce training and also to reduce the overall cost of an undergraduate degree. Joining us for this conversation are Lee Lambert, who is the chancellor of the Pima Community College District, Steve Katsinas, who is the director of the Educational Policy Center and professor of higher education at the University of Alabama, and Scott Jasek, co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Lee Lambert at Pima Community College, let me begin with you, and I'd like to place the budget cuts that confront your institution and Maricopa in context. It looks like you've gone from about $20 million in 2009 to $0 this year. First, just to give us a little bit of context, what's the percentage of the state funding for your institution? And the second, it looks like the major cut actually occurred a couple of years ago when you went from about $18 to $6 million. So some might argue this is just denouement, and yet for others it's still symbolically very significant.
Good morning, Casey. First of all, I just want to say, the governor and this legislature, they were put into a bad spot coming into this session with over a $1 billion problem they have to address. So, and following the trends, as you pointed out earlier, this outcome was very predictable. In fact, I told my team when I first started at Pima that we should plan for the day we get $0 from the state. So this was a predictable trend.
Again, let's focus on the impact. You're at, like many metropolitan urban community colleges, a large population of low-income students of all ages, minority students, students who need developmental education. You do a lot of workforce training. The loss of that last $6.5 million from what was once almost $20 million in 2009, what will that do and how will that play out?
Well, I think a big part of what it's going to do is to start out some new initiatives we were ready to roll out. It will also impact our ability to make sure we have the up-to-date equipment, especially for programs like aviation and automotive and nursing. So it's the things that we wanted to move into the future with where it'll probably have the greatest impact.
Steve Katsinas, you watch the landscape of these kinds of budget decisions. What's your take about what's happened at Arizona?
This is predictable. Willie Sutton once said that the reason you rob banks is that's where the money is. Even higher education in 1970 was about 20% of many states' total expenditure. It was down to about 10% by 2000, but it's still the biggest discretionary item in state government today. So this is the first place that budget directors and governors look for funds.
And Scott Jasek at Inside Higher Ed, the cuts in Arizona come even as other states are actually upping their investment in community colleges, both for issues about workforce training and also as part of a strategy to reduce the cost of an undergraduate degree.
Well, in some states, yes, but in many states, no. I mean, I think it's important, and Steve's data speak to this, community colleges regularly get the short end of the stick and all kinds of things. But what I think is really significant here is zero. As you pointed out in the intro, or in your first question, Arizona could hardly be accused of being generous to its community colleges in recent years. So it's not the total sum, but to me, and the way our readers strongly reacted to this news was, something is wrong with the system when a state can go to zero. States don't hesitate to regulate community colleges. They depend on community colleges for their whole higher ed system. Going to zero, I think, is hitting a lot of people as a philosophic shift, as a important moment that is more important than losing $2 million.
This is Steve Katsinas. I think the thing to remember is, in constant inflation adjusted dollars between FY8 and 2012, according to Chef, state higher education finance officers, 11 states took cuts of greater than 30%, 17 took cuts between 20 and 30%, 18 between 5 and 20%. Just two states, Illinois and North Dakota, saw increases in funding, and Illinois' increase was entirely eaten up by pensions. Our national surveys for FY 2013-14 found 14 states failing to predict that appropriations would exceed the inflation rate for last year, and for this year it's 31 states. So a majority of the states say they're going to fail to hit the inflation rate this year. To me, this says that we're not seeing state investment, we're seeing state disinvestment.
And I think, building off of that,
I think
what's also important to keep in mind, the way funding was structured is an artifact of the 20th century. We really start to need to think about how we fund higher education going forward in a different kind of model. The FTE basis for our calculations just don't work for the kinds of students we interact with today, the types of programs we offer today. So I think it raises larger questions than the fact that there's been this trend. With that said, I came from a different state just over 19, 20 months ago. I had less per dollars from public dollars in that state than I do currently from the state of Arizona. So you have to keep it in a larger perspective as well.
Lee, I want to look at the issue of institutional control over revenue to follow up your point. Even as the state is taking money, are you constrained in terms of tuition issues? I mean, that's happened in other states where the state has cut budgets, but at the same time also put caps or restricted the ability of institutions, two- and four-year institutions, to raise tuition.
The tuition issue is a very complicated one, as you can imagine. So my board here at Pima, we have the local ability to raise tuition and fees. However, you have to look at it in the context of the community you're operating in. Tucson is the fifth poorest community for its size in the country. So for us to raise tuition and fees on the fifth poorest community in the country for its size would have devastating impacts. And then if you look at federal aid, it doesn't keep up with the real cost to students. So that's also an important factor. So we're not going to be able to make up these differences through tuition and shifting that burden to students.
And Steve, I want to come back to a point that you made in terms of both real dollars and nominal dollars. So even as many have declared the Great Recession over, in fact, the budget cuts and the consequences of the Great Recession continue for all of higher education, in particular for community colleges.
That's correct. We find this last year in our annual surveys, we found the most challenging funding environment and competition for public higher education funding since we began our surveys 12 years ago.
And what's when you say competition, what do you mean by competition? Is it within sectors of higher education? Higher education versus K-12, prisons, public services?
Our surveys look at 11 different key state priorities. Medicaid and K-12 education were the top budget drivers in 2014 state legislative sessions. Recession producing a decline in income was the first, the decline in revenue was the first, this was the first time since the Great Recession it wasn't in the top three. But higher education fell behind some other priorities, including corrections, and what we think's going on is a whole lot of entities have been told, wait your turn, we'll take care of you when the recession ends, and higher education is on the low end of the totem pole compared to highways, pensions, K-12, as we come out of the recession. And this is part of why there's a growing body of research that says that the bounce back from a recession is taking longer and longer and longer since Vietnam War.
And Scott, the state money, even as it's declined dramatically in Arizona, as we've seen from the numbers provided in the article earlier this week at Inside Higher Ed, symbolically and substantively would still seem to matter more to community colleges than it does to four-year institutions. Historically, community colleges have not had some of the other avenues that four-year public institutions have had to raise other money from other sources.
Yes, I think that's very important. Right now, this year in Arizona, there are also deep cuts being proposed to the four-year universities, and I don't mean to in any way minimize the importance there. But when a research university gets its state funds cut, it can do ambitious fundraising at a scale greater than most community colleges. Many research universities are admitting more out-of-state students, admitting more full-pay students. Likewise, some can do shifts in tuition that are difficult for community colleges for the reasons we heard a minute ago, because they're serving so many low-income students. So a dollar lost to a community college may be much more difficult to replace, however entrepreneurial and creative that college is.
And Lee, I want to come back to you from something you said in your first statement, that the state of Arizona confronted a significant budget challenge, about $1 billion. And yet, across the landscape, perhaps in Arizona, certainly we've seen this in some other states, it seems that the effort to cut money from higher education is driven as much by politics as it is by budget issues. How political is the issue in Arizona in terms of you've got a Republican governor, you've got a Republican legislature? We've seen this play out in some other states as well.
Well, you know, it's easy if in isolation you look at this, it's easy to think it's based on party. But as I noted earlier, I came from a different state where it was the different party that was in, and we faced similar challenges. So I think the pressures hearing from the other panelists in this conversation really reflects a larger set of macro issues that are going on in our economy. And I think what this reflects, and I hate to say this, but America's on the decline. And because we're on the decline, there's less federal and state resources to distribute to some important priorities. You know, roads and bridges are very important, just as well as higher education is. So until we re-examine the reality of what's going on and start to look for new revenue sources, we're going to continue to face this, and I think other states will be looking at zero. Zero is very dramatic.
Let me also ask you, in terms of the impact in this context of the president's proposal, the likelihood that it goes forward about free community college tuition, given that there was some design in that or some model as part of the proposal that the states would take a more engaged role and there'd be more federal money, what happens if that, on the odd chance that, in fact, we do move to free community college tuition? And what does that do in Arizona, given state funding today?
First of all, if you look at the president's proposal, it requires a match. Presently, the state of Arizona does not provide tuition assistance like many other states in the form of some type of aid to students who attend institutions of higher education. So to think if that's not happening, and how do you turn around and provide a match? So I think that proposal would not play out the same way here as it might in other places.
And Steve, same question to you in terms of that matching component, given what you've told us about the fact the states are continuing to pull money out of community colleges in many instances, as opposed to expand the support for community colleges.
Maintenance of effort in the president's proposal is the key piece of this. We're about to publish a study that'll show 100 community colleges at 100 getting less than 5% of the total funding from the state. No performance funding measure is going to make a difference when you're getting that small of a percentage. In our country, the number of associate degrees and first certificates awarded rose by 75% and 122% respectively from 2001 to 2013. However, our national survey this year found for the first time that degree completion is going down or remaining flat in a majority of the states. So if America's going to become number one in the world again, it's going to have to do a different approach. A new way forward is going to be needed. We think that maintenance of effort in the president's proposal is going to be important.
And Scott Jasek, education is as much a part of the national infrastructure as our roads and bridges. Peter Drucker once referred to community colleges as Americans' hidden resource in terms of economic competitiveness, in terms of the training that they do, and yet it would seem to be very clear, you know, much like roads and bridges, it's clear we are not investing in that essential infrastructure.
Well, and I'd say it's also about not paying enough attention to community colleges. You know, in the recent weeks, we've reported on the demise of Sweetbriar College, a small college with some 700 students. Again, that matters to a lot of people. But if you look at the national reaction to that and compare it to the complete state disinvestment from community colleges in Arizona with so many more students, the majority of them low-income students, part of this is which colleges get the attention, which prompt people to rise up and say this shouldn't happen. And I think too often the attention goes to institutions other than community colleges, even when what they do is so important.
Great. Lee Lambert from Pima Community College, Steve Katsinas from the University of Alabama, and Scott Jasek, thank you for the conversation this morning about funding for community colleges. In our second segment today, we talk about a new advocacy strategy for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. This week, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation announced a new advocacy plan that focuses on what the foundation calls, quote, student-centered business and education models, end quote. The new advocacy strategy will focus on four key issues, data and information, finance and financial aid, college readiness, and innovation and scale. The new strategy draws on the foundation's continuing expertise and significant investments in post-secondary education projects and programs, some $73 million just this past year, and almost over $500 million over the past 7 years. Some in the campus community welcome the foundation's efforts, leadership, and, of course, significant financial support. Others are skeptical about and perhaps even clearly hostile to the foundation's efforts, programs, and policy priorities. Joining us for this conversation are Dan Greenstein, the Director of Education for Postsecondary Success at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Scott Thomas, Professor of Education and Dean of the School of Educational Studies at Claremont Graduate University, and Scott Jasek from Inside Higher Ed. Also, I need to disclose that the Gates Foundation is a sponsor of the Campus Computing Project, and I moderated sessions for the Gates Foundation at the recent South by Southwest Educational Summit in Austin earlier this week. Dan, let me begin with you. What are student-centered business and education models cited in the advocacy document, and how will these models reflect the four policy areas that are now priority issues for the foundation? Those areas are data and information, finance and financial aid, college readiness, and innovation and scale.
Sure. Thanks, Casey, and thanks for the invitation to participate. As you know, the Gates Foundation works on ensuring that more students are able to acquire a affordable, high-value post-secondary credential, and focus in particular on low-income, first-generation students and historically underserved students from underserved communities. And what we've learned through our partners over the years is that in order to serve those students better, to provide that affordable path to a high-value credential, you don't just do more of the same, you have to provide education in different ways. And the strategy focuses on supporting colleges and universities that wish to implement those various different approaches. So the policy priorities really enable us to focus on policies that provide incentives for institutions that want to follow that path and serve their students better. And a perfect example would be outcomes-based funding, where implemented well provides real incentives for institutions to serve low-income, first-gen, and historically underserved students better. Would be a perfect example of that.
So is the policy document released this week a new strategy, or in fact is this an understandable evolution of an existing strategy given the fact that the foundation has been doing this for 7 years? Does it reflect ramping up, or does it reflect some shifts and turns?
It's really an acceleration. You know, having put in place the institutional focus, then it's possible to build the policy arm around it, and that's really what you're seeing here, coupled with the real, you know, profound and abiding interest in being transparent about the work we're doing. So lifting it up to the web and making it widely available is super important to us.
And what will be different over the next 2 to 3 years given the document and given the
you see the document providing a framework for further analysis and evaluation, but also really now beginning to join in the advocacy, in the advocacy arena, beginning to drive adoption of policies, working through our partners to drive adoption of policies that are proving to work and be effective in higher education, ensuring that more colleges and universities are able to serve their students better.
Scott Thomas, Claremont Graduate University, you have been following the activities of the Gates Foundation as well as other foundations that focus on education. Your take on the strategies document released this week and what this means in terms of the activities and the initiatives of the Gates Foundation?
Oh, I believe it's an important step forward, and I think it's a laudable focusing of the efforts of Gates. So on that count, I think that this is exactly what I would want if I were on the boards of the Gates Foundation. It's going to move them forward to think more strategically about implementing things that have proven to work in their previous funded projects, and then putting them into four areas of focus. So I think in that sense, this is a good way forward for them.
And Scott Jasek at Inside Higher Ed, you too have been watching the Gates Foundation in terms of its initiatives in post-secondary education. What's your take in terms of the article published this week, in terms of the response to the article this week about this, what may be a new initiative or just an incremental ramping up of the initiatives and the strategy at the foundation?
Well, you know, in some ways, I think people can't be surprised that Gates has opinions on these things. Nobody has accused the Gates Foundation of being laissez-faire about the world. They're trying to promote certain strategies, and it's their money. I did see, though, a fairly strong reader reaction of people questioning some of these priorities. I'm not hearing anybody say that the ideas in there about data collection and the use of data can be questioned, but not everyone agrees with the Gates approach on, say, remedial education. I'd say most everyone agrees dealing with remedial education is really important, but not everyone on that approach. And then I also think in academia there's a natural dislike of or skepticism, I should say, of large organizations. And that's not unique to Gates, but Gates is, in fact, a large organization with a lot of influence, so people naturally are asking questions.
Dan, let me come back to you. In an email from your colleague Gabriela Gomez, deputy director at the foundation, previously an officer at the U.S. Department of Education, in an email cited in the Inside Higher Education piece this week about the foundation's new strategy, she wrote that the new strategy focuses, quote, about us providing policies based on what we know will provide the greatest leverage for change, and in some instances based on what we know works, end quote. I'd like to know sort of providing what kinds of policies and policies to whom, at the obviously state and federal level, but again, if you can clarify that for us.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've nailed it. I mean, it really is focusing in the state and federal arena specifically. The real emphasis is on policies that affect money and measures. I mean, simply put, money, respective outcomes-based funding approaches at state level, federal financial aid at the federal. Measures is really about, how we capture and use information about institutional performance in providing education to their students.
Scott Thomas, again, you've been watching this in terms of the providing policies, advocacy for policy. What's your take in terms of the effort that Gates will now move forward with in terms of state and federal policy?
Well, I think this is where they enter the area of real contention with many people at the university. The question, I think, is whose mission is being pursued here, higher education or the philanthropies? And higher education would see their mission as teaching, research, and service is essential. And the philanthropies will look to see where the carrying out the aims of the university fits with the objectives of the philanthropy. And in this instance, when that works, it's wonderful. But when the philanthropy has objectives and aims that are really outside the scope of the views of the institutions that they're trying to shape, there will always be tension. And I think that's what we're seeing here. And we're seeing it on a number of fronts. We'll see faculty pushing back on what administrators may see as a good opportunity for strengthening their academic programs or their teaching programs primarily, and injecting a little more accountability into that. But faculty will have different views on that I could explore separately.
Is the devil, Scott Thomas, in the details here? I mean, I'm thinking about Dan's comments earlier in terms of the Foundation's stated goals and objectives in education about providing access and opportunity, college completion. Is the devil, and in one sense, the resistance into the details in terms of the how that happens at many institutions?
Well, it is how that happens. I don't think anybody's going to take issue with the broad objectives of providing more affordable, high value post-secondary education to students that have traditionally been underserved. I mean, that's a laudable goal. But it's as much as how you get there and whose voices were included in understanding ways forward to achieve that objective. And people in the academy believe that they have a number of ways in which they've made great strides toward that end, and there are alternative solutions that aren't being proposed by Gates, perhaps, in the view of many, that are achieving the same ends. But when you have an outside entity come in and try to leverage institutional, state, federal resources toward that solution through their means, that gets people hot.
And Scott Jasek, as somebody who's watching the landscape, how much influence has the Gates Foundation had at the state and federal level, and you know, what's the likelihood that they will have more influence given the strategies and the advocacy, the materials outlined in the advocacy document released this week?
I think they've had a significant influence, although it's also the case that the idea that Gates is grappling with, poor completion rates, for instance, naturally concern people at the state and federal level too. And so there's a lot of consensus among federal, state leaders and foundation leaders, and not just Gates, that these are important questions. The criticism that I'm hearing is, which issues should Gates speak out about? So, for instance, I just posted a comment saying on our coverage of the story, asking the question that if Gates is going to say we want to deal with states that do certain things, is Gates going to say, for instance, that what Arizona is trying to do, which is to eliminate all state funds for certain community colleges, is wrong, or set some sort of like maintenance of effort standard so that colleges aren't adopting what Gates might consider the right policies, but also taking away resources from their institutions? And I guess that's my question to Dan. Will Gates be speaking out on those things as well?
You know, it's interesting. A couple of things. One of them is the way the foundation works in the advocacy arena. It's really coalescing the work of our partners, and we're not an operating foundation. And so the work that we're publishing or results from, you know, countless conversations with policymakers, faculty, institution leaders, et cetera. And then the research that we're able to support to identify and articulate policy positions, and then where we can to evaluate those that work. So that's super important. The issue of funding is, as you know, it's critical and continues in a very interesting and challenging direction, exacerbated in some ways by where we are in the political election cycle. And this is an issue of considerable concern, especially if you consider, as we do, education as a public good.
Scott Thomas, I want to come back to you in terms of the reaction to the foundation's initiatives. You know, clearly, there's a mixed response depending on where you are and what your roles and responsibilities. Many campus officials seem to welcome the foundation's focus on access, equity, outcomes, and not surprisingly, the money that their institutions receive to support those initiatives and some innovative programs. Others, including many faculty, are antagonistic to what they view to be the foundation's emphasis on data, performance metrics, and technology. Some of that may best be an immediate response to some of the semantics. Performance metrics don't go well in the higher ed community as they don't go well in the K-12 community. What's your take about the source of antagonism to the foundation's initiatives?
I think, you know, twofold. One, I think Gates represents an authoritative source for many administrative models and also revenue to support instructional efforts on campuses that would improve learning outcomes that are associated with these high-value post-secondary education experiences. So from an administrative perspective, I think there is a lot of attraction to many of the Gates efforts that have been developed on campuses. From a faculty perspective, I think that there's a concern about deliberate alignment of education with technical skills and training associated with, you know, the career and workforce model as opposed to the liberal arts model. And the liberal arts model among the faculty is one that is quite important, and the flexibility that comes along with that liberal arts training is always seen as being more adaptable than the static skills provided by career and technical workforce training. And I think many conflate the language, and I think there is a rhetoric component here that's important. Many conflate the language in a lot of the Gates efforts and other foundation efforts that are focused on, you know, really providing students with a strong set of workforce-ready skills coming out. They conflate that with kind of career and technical training rather than the broad aims of liberal arts training that is championed in many university environments.
And Dan, to Scott Thomas's point about career tech skills versus broader liberal arts kinds of education and that critique?
Leaders in higher education continue to tell me that and it's true, higher education is incredibly diverse sector, providing a whole range of different approaches, which is a very good thing, from vocational education right through to the most elite forms of liberal arts education and sort of research preparedness. And all of those things are important. The challenge, of course, is that, you know, going forward, it needs to become and to continue to build on its strength as an engine of social mobility, economic development, and also a means of ensuring a citizenry which is able to contribute well to the healthy life of this democracy. All those things are super important. Our role, I think, is to provide, you know, the evidence around tools and approaches that work and help higher education fulfill its various missions, allowing faculty and leaders at institutions and policymakers to choose as they will which they'll adopt. And the hope, of course, is they adopt those on the basis of good empirical information, which we hope to support.
So, Dan, on the issue of empirical information, the foundation has been a strong advocate for data and metrics of success in terms of the activities of its grantees. Let me turn this around a little bit. A year from now, 3 years from now, what would be the appropriate metrics of success given the advocacy plan that was released this week?
Well, I think it depends on which particular policy issue you're speaking to. So, for example, take outcomes-based funding. You know, there you'd see how many states are implementing a high level of successful outcomes-based funding. We have a paper on this and define different approaches. So we would be looking for those states who are, you know, adopting the sort of highest performing approach, and then expecting to see greater student success in those states. With respect of financial aid, you'll see in another month or so positions around streamlining FAFSA, for example, and you'd expect to see with a streamlined FAFSA more people accessing financial aid and getting across the threshold of college and hopefully performing well there. So I think it varies, but the importance of the measurement and using consistent measurement is so that you know, I mean, reference to DevEd, so that you know when the next implementation of developmental education or the next change in the implementation of developmental education actually works better or worse than the last one. And unless you use standard approaches to measure, you can't know, and so there's no continuous improvement. And that's really, that aim is really under all of our interest in measurement.
Great. Dan Greenstein from the Gates Foundation, Scott Thomas from the Claremont Graduate University, and Scott Jasek from Inside Higher Ed, thank you for the conversation about the new policy initiatives from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Our thanks as well to Lee Lambert from Pima Community College and Steve Katsinas from the University of Alabama for the discussion of the politics and programmatic impacts of the decision in Arizona not to provide state money to three large community colleges. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is available as an audio stream or podcast early afternoon on most Fridays. On the web, we are available at insidehighered.com/thisweek. This Week is also available on iTunes. Please share your thoughts about This Week with us on the comments section of the webpage. Thank you.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.